This is a Red Pepper Magazine, Transnational Institute and Free Word Center debate about how the military and corporations are planning for a climate-changed world in ways which will affect us all.
Thank you all for coming tonight. My name is Rivka Barnard and I'm the campaigns officer on militarism and security at War and Want. And I'm really happy to be here tonight to moderate this event, the book launch for The Secure and the Dispossessed. And we're going to get to hear a lot of great things about this book. I just want to start by saying something about the co-organizers for this event, to thank the co-organizers, which is a really amazing lineup of organizations, Global Justice Now, Platform, Campaign Against Arms Trade, War on Want, TNI, the Transnational Institute, State Watch, Friends of the Earth, and Red Pepper. So there's pretty much the most amazing lineup of organizations you could ever imagine, so we're guaranteed to have a great night ahead. I'm going to also introduce our four speakers, and I'm just going to tell you a little bit about them all before we start. And each of them is going to speak very briefly, not too briefly, but kind of briefly, and then we'll have a chance to discuss the book a little bit more. And after the event, there's going to be opportunities for everyone to buy a copy and get it signed by the exciting people who have edited it. Right, so let me just start by introducing the speakers, and then we'll hear all about the book when our panelists start speaking. So the first speaker is Asad Rahman. He coordinates Friends of the Earth's international climate work, and he is a star interviewee in Naomi Klein's recent film, This Changes Everything. He's been also actively involved in countless anti-racist and social justice struggles in London for many years, so we'll hear a little bit more about that. The second speaker is one of the co-editors of the book, and that's Ben Hayes. He's the co-editor of this book, The Secure and the Dispossessed. He is a TNI fellow who has worked on the civil liberties organization State Watch since 1996, specializing in national and international security policies. He's also the author of Neocon Opticon, the EU Security Industrial Complex, which is published by Transnational Institute in 2009. And he's written widely on the impact of counterterrorism on human rights, peace building, and civil society, on border control and the development of Fortress Europe, and on surveillance before and after Edward Snowden. A lot of exciting topics there. Our third speaker is going to be Nick Buxton, who's the other co-editor of the book. He is the communications manager for the Transnational Institute, and has been involved in global justice and environmental justice movements for over 20 years. He is the editor of TNI's annual State of Power Reports and the book Shifting Power, Critical Perspectives on Emerging Economies, and that's 2015. The last, but certainly not least, speaker is Joe Ram, who's the co-founder of Community Reinvest, which is an organization that works with the fossil fuel divestment movement to demystify finance and enable reinvestment of divested funds into a democratic and just energy system. She teaches social action and climate change at University College London, and she's a member of the Red Pepper Editorial Collective and an activist also with the Art Not Oil Coalition. So that's the amazing panel that we're going to be speaking from, that we're going to be hearing from, and I'm really excited to hear from all of you. So I'm going to start just by asking Asad to begin and tell us a little bit about the climate change march coming up and some other topics, I think.
Let me tell you a little bit first about climate change. Thank you for the introduction. I love being reduced to a little cameo in Naomi's film. I think the reality, of course, now is you don't really need to be a climate scientist, and you don't need to be an environmentalist to understand that climate change is happening, it's real, and its impacts are devastating people all around the world. You know, we see the super typhoons, for example, such as the one that hits the Philippines with super typhoon Kayan, killed 7,000 people and displaced 3 million people. These were once every 100 years typhoons, then started happening every 10 years and now happening either every year or every other year. One flood, for example, in Pakistan, where I'm from, impacted 30 million people. We have a drought that in the Sahel that has impoverished and impacted 15 million people in 9 countries. Everywhere you look, climate change and climate impacts are impacting people. And of course, these are all impacts that are happening at a 1 degree warming of the planet. And, you know, in Australia, the meteorological office had to create a new colour to measure the temperature that had been recorded in Australia. And Hurricane Patricia off the coast of Mexico required a new level of intensity. Never before had we had a hurricane with such an intensity. So violent weather impacts are actually happening. And of course, climate in itself is the greatest injustice of all things. Yeah. The rich, the most powerful, the ones who are responsible for the climate crisis, are not the ones who are dealing with the impacts of climate change. It's the poorest of the poor, the ones who have least responsibility. There was a study done in the United States which said that 7% of the world, the richest 7% of the world, are responsible for over 50% of historical emissions around the world. And of course, we already live in a deeply unequal world. Last week was World Sanitation Day, which talked about the fact there was about 2.5 billion people who don't have access to sanitation. There's about 700 million people who don't have access to fresh water, over about 1.5 billion people who don't have access to electricity, and about 2.5 billion people who don't have access to clean cooking facilities. And yet, you know, it's not that we lack the finance or we lack the ability to be able to deal with these problems. It's the fact that 85 families own over 50% of global wealth, and that 80% of the world's population could together only own 5% of global wealth. So climate change exasperates deeply unequal and inequitable issues. And of course, it's what drives it and what makes climate change such a difficult issue in the sense of for some to deal with is the fact that it's, of course, an economic issue. People who tell you that climate change is about an environmental issue, absolutely wrong. Climate change is about economy, political economy. I follow the negotiations at the UN, and climate is, that's not, nobody talks about environment. What they're really talking about is political economy. The US lead negotiator Todd Stern once said a couple of years ago that the one thing that's not up for negotiations is the American way of life. And what he really meant was that what's not up for way of life is the role of the US capital, US economy, and US corporations. And I thought he was very, very honest about that. And of course, we know what he meant was the fact that 5% of the world's population in the United States have a per capita income of about $44,000, while in India, the big emerging economy, we keep being told, with about 18% of the world's population has a per capita income of just over $3,000, while the poorest 11% of the world have a per capita income of about $1,000. Now, if you don't understand those things, then, of course, when you're asking governments to act, why aren't they acting? Why aren't they acting rationally? When climate scientists tell us we're heading towards a trajectory of between 4 to 5 degree warming, even the World Bank, not the most revolutionary of organisations, telling us if we carry on with that trajectory, the world will be only sustainable for about 1 billion people. We've got the IPCC climate scientists telling us this is within by year 2020, 50 to 250 million people in Africa will be affected by water stressors, 50% drop in agricultural yields in some countries. The reality of climate change is absolutely very, very clear there. But unless you understand why and the drivers of climate change, you don't understand why we're not acting. And of course, what we're not acting is there are much more powerful vested interests saying, don't act, rather than and not listening to the voices of us as citizens. Or the other powerful voices are saying, don't act in the way that we actually would resolve the climate crisis, tackle inequality, or create a much more equal world. What we want is either techno fixes or a way that we can maintain the dominant economic situation. And that, I think, of course, is very much what Ben and Nick will talk about in terms of their book. I really want to talk also about, you know, our challenge, of course, is as people who believe in justice, is that we know we have the solutions to the climate crisis. The solutions are all there. We can repower Africa. We can, by the wealth of just 50 people, of some of the richest people, we can power the whole of Latin America by less than the wealth of 30 people. We can bring agroecology, which challenges the agro-industrial model, feeds the world three times over. Absolutely no shortage of solutions. What we lack, of course, is the ability to be able to put those solutions into practice, which is fundamentally about power, which brings us to why we need to do movement building. And movement building for me, and I try and say this message everywhere, and I'm sorry if you've heard me speak, is not about climate change, is not about tomorrow. It's not about people's kids' generation. You know, I mean, I think if you want to talk about how to demotivate a movement, how to create a movement that has no urgency, no agency, and doesn't speak to people, you would create a climate movement like the movement we've got today, which talks about, don't worry about it now, it's in your kids' generation. Don't worry about it, it's about the polar bears. Don't worry about it, just change your light bulb. All things that just don't connect with people. What we actually need to be talking about is making people understand who's responsible for the climate crisis, that there are names and addresses of climate change. You know, it's not abstract. They're in the financial city. There are banks and corporations. And those are the people who are responsible for tackling, for blocking action on climate change. We need to talk to people about ways that they connect with them in terms of climate change. And that really means talking about warm homes here, to mean talking about climate jobs, talking about community energy, things that actually matter because they challenge the power dynamics that we've got. And of course, it's about just standing in solidarity with people all around the world. And that, I think, there are real hope. The way ordinary people resisted the narrative and framing from our media and our government around the refugee crisis and turned out on the street, I think, gave a lot of people incredible hope. I was in Germany and I saw people driving across the border, bringing people across the border in their cars. This real people power, I think, is where our solution is going to be. And I'm hoping that this book, like I think quite a few others, like Naomi's book, like are all part of a way to retool the movement, of reshape the movement, to make the movement understand how we join the dots between our fights in terms around the military-industrial complex, the fight against war, the fight, all of these things. I don't need to tell you, Prince Charles has said it himself a few days ago, that, you know, of course, all conflicts and crises are impacted. And there are many, many different reasons why people leave their homes, for example. But climate change, of course, is one of them. In Syria, 5-year drought, you know, led to 80% of all livestock dying between 2006 and 11. 2 million people displaced from rural areas into urban areas, exasperating existing tensions. Anybody who's studied the Arab Spring will tell you that Arab Spring, one of the many reasons for the Arab Spring, of course, was also the fact that the agriculture and the harvest had collapsed and food prices had tripled. We all know that social injustices connected to each other lead to all of these political crises. And the question now is how do we use the political crisis and the economic and the climate crisis to rebuild a better world? And how do we challenge those powers? And I'm hoping Ben and Nick will tell us exactly how to do that. Thank you.
Amazing. Thank you very much for that. Under time.
For once in my life, I was under time. I can say more.
It's very amazing, though. And you get extra credit for being under time. And also, really, a lot of thanks for that context, which is, I think, really the essential context for the book, and of course, a part of the book also. But now I'm really excited to turn it over to Ben, who's going to talk about the book itself that we're all here to celebrate.
So. Okay, thanks. So I just want to talk a little bit about, you know, where the idea for the book came from and how it was to write it. And, you know, I guess the first thing I'm going to say, this was a really hard book to write, right? Because, you know, it requires you to take seriously the possibility that Western governments have given up on the idea that they can stop climate change or prefer to live with the consequences. And, you know, in taking that seriously, you know, it's not good for the soul, right? And I'm going to come back to that. And you know, one of the reasons that we are where we are now is over the past sort of 10 to 15 years is, you know, security experts, social scientists have, as Asad said, you know, they've started saying that, well, you know, climate change is clearly going to exacerbate all of the problems that we're already struggling to cope with, right? Resource wars, failed states, climate refugees, food prices, social unrest, all of this stuff, right? All the things that are on our TV screens every day. And it's a very dystopian vision that we're presented with, right? And as, you know, the novelist Zadie Smith said, you know, it's pretty hard to keep the apocalypse constantly in mind, especially if you want to get out of bed in the morning, right? And, you know, this is a problem because when we look around the world, you know, the threats appear very real. And one of the things we wanted to do with the book is you know, take seriously the idea of climate change as a threat multiplier. So the first chapter is by an American journalist called Christian Parenti, and it's just a bridge from his book, Tropic of Chaos. And he basically looks at what he calls new geographies of violence, right, and the links between climate change, conflict and insecurity. And he focuses his research on the central latitudes, the places that are most affected by changes in weather patterns. And he produces a whole bunch of evidence that suggests climate change is, you know, has been overlooked in a, as a factor in some of the conflicts Assad talked about, but, you know, across the MENA region, Middle East, North Africa, East Africa, Afghanistan, and, of course, in the Arab Spring. So the threat that climate change poses, you know, is to the dynamics that shape security, right, is very real, and we have to take that seriously. But, you know, as Assad said, it doesn't happen in a vacuum, right? So for Parenti, the key thing and the reason we liked his work is that the environmental crisis is colliding really with the sort of the twin legacies of Cold War militarism and unbridled free market economics, right? And it's these things that are in turn inflaming existing conflicts and creating what he calls these new geographies of violence. And in turn, right, you know, governments, the wider international community, how are they responding to this? Well, they're responding with greater repression, with counterinsurgency, with mass surveillance, and all of the things that we're probably now all too familiar with. So that's really the backdrop for the book. And sort of from this position, it's very easy to see why governments and national security agencies and all of these think tanks are now continuously banging on about climate change, you know, being the greatest national security threat that we face. But, you know, what we try to do with the book is stress that what matters most is how these issues are framed and how the framing is done. Now, I actually became interested in this particular topic in the summer of 2008 when the EU published its climate change and international security strategy. And it was sort of, you know, all the top brass of the EU security apparatus came together and they produced this sort of now familiar idea that climate change is this threat multiplier. And what they said is that, you know, climate change threatens to overburden states and regions which are already fragile and conflict prone. And this leads to political and security risks that directly affect European interests. And this for us was a bit of a sort of watershed moment at TNI, because once the EU starts to think about, you know, how to protect its own interests, its foreign assets, its supply chains, its access to resources, its borders, its client states, you start putting these interests ahead of those people facing environmental catastrophe. And then sort of from this point of view, once you start saying that climate change is a threat to your strategic interests, you start seeing, you know, the likely victims of climate change, not just as disposable people, you know, and who really cares about, you know, a billion black or brown people in the world's poorest countries who are most vulnerable. When you start saying that these people are a threat to your strategic interests, you start seeing them not as victims, but as threats to your security itself. And I think that was really the biggest motivation for writing the book, right? Suddenly, all of these people, they're no longer, you know, the victims who are having to deal with this crisis, they're suddenly potential climate refugees. They're the people who are going to be the future insurgents. These are the people who are susceptible to radicalization, right? And if you read, you know, a lot of these climate change and security strategies as I have, what you really see is this kind of failed state narrative transplanted onto the entire global south. And then what you see is that the writers of these strategies, what they're really doing is sitting around doing what's called foresighting exercises, or what we would call war games, right? So they sit there and you get all these bright young things and they start saying, well, you know, what's going to happen when, you know, new waves of drought and famine hit East Africa? Or what's going to happen when Bangladesh is rendered uninhabitable by sea level rise? And the answer is always chaos and insecurity, right? Not cooperation, not solidarity, not conflict resolution, right? Because these concepts are somehow alien to the war gamers, right? So we're left with this discourse that essentially, you know, takes conflict for granted and places self-preservation and self-interest ahead of, you know, dealing with the root causes of environmental security. And all of this, of course, is sort of couched in these kind of neo-Malthusian scares, right? You know, too many people, not enough to go around, the Earth's reached its carrying capacity, you know, we've got all these uncivilized black and brown people, you know, Arabs and Africans who know nothing but violence, you know, it's all hopeless, right? And, you know, what we try to do in this book is really critique these discourses, and I think it's essential that we do so, but I also find it deeply troubling that there's this sort of narrative that's emerged that anyone on the left or journalists or activists who start talking about this stuff, you know, suddenly we're written off as doomers, you know. And, you know, I kind of totally agree that, you know, waiting for the collapse of capitalism or hoping for some sort of rebirth after the environmental apocalypse is, you know, is probably the worst foundation for progressive politics, right? But I cannot for the life of me understand why the sort of the progressives who've taken it upon themselves to sort of police environmental and left-wing thought aren't focusing their critiques of catastrophism on the state, right? States which are, you know, so enthralled to corporations, so bereft of ideas to deal with global problems, you know, that national security has basically become the only effective means through which states can maintain and extend their control over restive populations, you know. So I think, you know, dystopia may not be in the interests of progressive politics, but it is, it's very, very good for the state, right? You know, so we should see the hyping of the climate threat, if you like, you know, it should be seen as intimately linked to the hyping of the threat around terrorism, hyping up the threat from refugees, hyping up the threat from Jeremy Corbyn, hyping up the threat from people like us, right? And, you know, as it turns out, you know, nothing is better, you know, than scaring people shitless if on a whim, you know, you want to take £4 billion out of the hands of poor people and put it in the hands of the SAS and GCHQ, as George Osborne announced he was going to do last week. So there's one, you know, a whole bunch of stuff in the book, but one of the quotes I love is something from one of the US military top brass who said, you know, the trouble with climate change, it's like getting embroiled in a war that lasts 100 years. That's the scariest thing for us, right? And you start to think, well, how convenient, you know. And so, you know, we in this room, I think, we know that the emperor has no clothes, right? So what we try to do in the book is sort of start to push back on some of these ideas. So we point out, you know, that as many academics have, right, that the core belief that climate change or scarcity, you know, leads inevitably to chaos and conflict is not actually really supported by any social scientific evidence, right? We point out that just because environmental change, you know, may lead to localized forms of conflict, you know, it's actually ridiculous to state repeatedly that this amounts to this huge threat to national or global security. We point out that, you know, while there is tentative evidence of a correlation between temperature variation and civil unrest in specific regions, you know, the issue really remains highly contested among academics. You know, there's certainly no evidence whatsoever to support, you know, the hypotheses in the sort of national security and think tank guff coming out of the United States that, you know, we're two decades away from, you know, mass migration and widespread failed states. I think more importantly, we also point out that there's really little point in worrying about, you know, future scarcity and conflict and widespread human rights abuses caused by climate change when, as Assad said, you know, the structural conditions that are already producing scarcity, conflict, and widespread human rights abuses are already here now, and we can all see what they are. Another thing we try to do is we try to point out that, you know, contrary to the sort of elite panic and state repression that characterizes responses to disaster, you know, Hurricane Katrina, I'm sure you all remember that, the evidence suggests that ordinary people actually tend to behave very well in responding to disaster, and they do so with humanity and solidarity. So I'll just finish by saying, you know, a couple of things we hope to achieve with the book. you know, I guess if I've learned anything over the last 20 years, it's that, you know, knowing loads about security and having a better argument than the state doesn't really get you very far, right? But so, you know, if just at the very beginning, you know, we could get people to start, you know, questioning and pushing back against the framing of climate change as a national security issue, right? It's something you're going to be hearing more and more about every week. It's on the telly. You know, and one of the things we really try to do is sort of call out, particularly the US environmentalists who sort of jumped into bed with the military, who said, oh, isn't it wonderful, the military's taking climate change seriously at last, and, you know, we're going to get traction on all these other issues. That is a bankrupt political strategy. And the second thing we want to do with the book is really, you know, just to get people in the climate justice movement to start making the links and the connections between the issues they care about and the other social justice issues that we're all dealing with. I find it sort of amazing and depressing in equal measure that going into the COP21, you know, the only link that most environmental groups make between climate change and militarism is, oh, you know, but the military is the biggest polluter on Earth. And, you know, and, you know, if you look around, you know, you've got Saudi oil at $50 a barrel, right? You've got Islamic State, you know, born out of the ashes of our, you know, disastrous imperialist intervention there. You've got hundreds of thousands of refugees abjectly failed, you know, by the 500 million people of the European Union. You've got a state of emergency in France under which, you know, life must go on. We cannot let the terrorists win, but guess what? We're going to ban the climate mobilizations. You know, irony, anyone? You know, and we've got a NATO alliance that's, you know, sort of so fractured and outdated that, you know, we can't even decide who to bomb. You know, it's that bad. So, you know, never mind how to stabilise the region. So, you know, this is, it's difficult stuff. It's a difficult subject matter. There's no easy answers. But, you know, unless we start actually addressing the links between all of these different multiple crises, as Saad said, you know, we're not going to win on any of them. We had a little bit of a division of labour in the book. I did all the doom and the depressing stuff, and Nick did all the positive, inspirational stuff. So I'll hand over to him to get that going. Thanks.
Ben, and now we're going to hear from all the exciting, inspiring stuff from
Well, it's not all inspiring, but that's it. Does I do have some positive stuff to end with? Because one of the things I want to kind of pick up is Ben was talking about the military strategies, and I wanted to talk about how the kind of corporate strategies dovetail in with the military strategies. I first started thinking about this book. I think it was at the UN climate. We're just coming up to the UN climate talks, as you know, in Paris. But this was one back 5 years ago in Cancun, and it was my second one, and I was kind of shocked. I just felt I was in a really weird deja vu because I'd been at Copenhagen the year before, and then Cancun. It just seemed like everything was happening again. You had the same kind of romantic speeches by politicians at the beginning. You had the same kind of little NGO actions inside, which didn't seem to have any impact. You had people doing the blame game, saying it's all India's fault because they're growing too fast, or China's fault. And it felt like some kind of absurdist theatre. And I was just, it was quite clear that these were not the climate deniers of your usual type, the kind of the nutty right-wing Republicans. These were people who know the science, and yet were going through this kind of absurd game, which Assad has probably done about 12, I don't know how many you've had to suffer, but it's been going on for 23 years. And it made me just wonder, well, if there clearly is no decision to act, what are states and corporations, what are states and the main forces doing to actually prepare for the consequences? Because we know there are going to be consequences. And that's when we started to look into this issue, because I think quite rightly the environmental movement has focused on how we stop worsening climate change. But are we doing the kind of long-term look about who is planning for the consequences that are happening right now in terms of climate change? And that's where we started to look at these forces and really to start to get some a debate so that it isn't certain groups looking after the future, the groups that we don't want to have in charge of our future. And Ben has already talked about the military being one of the main forces. In the same And one of the big reports there, which started to talk about this idea of threat multiplier, was the one called The Age of Consequences that came in 2008. The same year, Shell did its long-term planning. It does these every about 10 years. It does these forecasting about what is the world we expect to operate in. And they came up with two scenarios, alternative scenarios that they imagined. One was called Blueprint, and one was called Scramble. And Scramble was this idea that we'd have this massive scramble for resources, you'd have rising competition, we'd have growing social and environmental conflicts. Sounds rather like the military strategies that Ben was talking about. The other was Blueprint, in which the world moved quickly towards a low-carbon future, where everything was run by molecules, kind of electrons rather than molecules, it said. So we'd have a kind of a non-fossil fuel economy. And Shell, you know, said, we normally don't pronounce, but we're in favor of Blueprint. But when you looked at what they meant, in the small print, it meant no change to their fossil fuel production at all. So it was a rather... They came up with lots of things that will have cap and trade schemes that will offset everything that we do. But we basically plan to move on as we normally do. And in 2 years later, they said, okay, we're not really, they even admitted, we're not really following the blueprint model at all. We're following Scramble. And that's what they did when they announced that they were going to go into the Arctic, which was something which is just... they've had a lot of problems with recently and they've now pulled back out. But that is basically the model they're committed to, Scramble. Now, you might expect this from a company like Shell, and they're not going to say, we want a future that doesn't involve us operating. That's kind of obvious. But what you see is a very similar pattern in a lot of long-term corporate planning. They're very much focused on how do we reduce our risk to our supply chains. And that might mean moving their warehouses from floodplain zones into things, or it might be trying to reduce kind of risks in terms of supply chains from getting certain commodities from conflict zones. But it doesn't really. But all the time they're expecting the military to back it up, and you'll see that actually in the UK Defence Review that just came out a couple of days ago. Does talk specifically about controlling supply chains during times of climate risk. So there's very much a dovetailing between a corporate strategy and a military strategy. It doesn't mean that no corporations are trying to do some good things in terms of reducing emissions, but there is lots of there's lots of greenwash behind that, and in the end there's no question of a global trade model and a profit-driven model that encourages unsustainable consumption. And what comes through in this, in a lot of these debates, is, and what you'll see in both military and corporate strategies, is two terms. One, which Ben's kind of picked up on. One is this idea of scarcity, this kind of Malthusian fight. And corporations say, well, the solution to that is security. So you've got scarcity on one side. We're going to have a very scarce world. And then we're going to have security resolutions to it. And from a corporate mind, that security comes from intensifying production, providing technological fixes, and using free market to resolve any issues. They look to profit while the military controls any of the consequences. And one of the chapters in the book looks at this through the lens of food security. And we'll notice that this word security enters everything. We have food security, water security, energy security. It's become the buzzword very much. And they're very much interlinked with the scarcity narrative. And if you look at food security, the chapter there, I think we know that supermarkets here control food very tightly. What we may not know is how concentrated the food chain is as a whole. There are actually just four companies who control about 80% of seeds. They control huge amounts of kind of like the global grain market trade is controlled up by about 90% by just four companies. And they very much have a model which depends on monoculture, pesticides, long-distance shipping, which means that actually they're one of the biggest contributors, agro-industry, to greenhouse gas emissions. Yet these companies are now promoting a food security narrative which is actually about expanding that model and doing almost nothing to confront their own very high fossil fuel use. And they're receiving a lot of funding for it as well, from whether it's through the Common Agricultural Policy in the EU or Obama's Feed the Future program in the US. And yet if we look the other side of the coin about how this affects people, we see that a lot of this food security narratives ends up being part of the global land grab that we've seen so dramatically since the food crisis in 2008. It ends up dispossessing small peasant farmers, increasing corporate control of the food chain, and actually ends up increasing impacts on the climate rather than the opposite. And the people and the communities and peasants who are going to feel real stresses from climate change are not the ones being bolstered and supported through this model. And so, in a sense, you're actually undermining the resilience of communities that is needed, which depends on diversity and depends on community control. It depends on community knowledge. Those are the things that actually will make communities more resilient to climate change. But instead, you have a model that is dispossessing and actually undermining that. And there is even huge speculation going on. And there's one of it looks also at some of the people who are the investment fund managers who are actually speculating on these shortages and looking to make money out of it. The same thing plays out with energy and water. And I don't know if you remember I think it was 2008, there were huge protests in King's North against a coal plant that was, there was a climate camp down there that was going to be expanded. And the government spent £5 million to police that protest. They did 8,000 stop and searches with the support and very much in coordination with the multinational company E.ON. And it was all framed in the terms of energy security. Even though there's no evidence at all that the protests would actually disrupt the power grid, as they admitted later, the police spokesperson at the time said, "We have to repress these civil liberties because these protests could deny you electricity to hospitals, schools, businesses, and your granny." So there was very much there was very much this kind of narrative that energy security would justify anything. And the trouble is that security really has become one of those weasel words. We might think of security as a good thing. You know, it's job security, it's the security of a roof over your house. But in the wake of 9/11, and in the wake now of the excuse of climate change, it's been used to justify all sorts of measures. So Ben has already talked about Paris. Security allows football matches to go ahead, but not protests. We see on the European policies right now, security is being used to actually put militarized borders against refugees to stop people being rescued in the Mediterranean. But what kind of security is that for refugees? So security is for one and dispossession for the other. And I think that our real concern is that climate change becomes more of that. It becomes an excuse for security policies which defend those who are already secure and dispossesses those who are already vulnerable. We really feel that if we can kind of continue with these policies of military and corporate strategies, it will actually increase the divisions of injustice that we already have, and that social movements really need to say that we want alternatives to a military and corporate-led future. Now the good news. The good news is that we asked this in each of the chapters, actually, was to get people to think about, to actually look realistically at what's happening, because we need to understand what we're up against. There's no point deceiving ourselves. But we also need to look at what are the alternatives. And what you see is many of the alternatives are being developed on the ground, because they're around how do we adapt to climate change in a just way that protects vulnerable people, that has principles of solidarity. I think we see many communities do that. There's movements like the Transition Town movement looking at that best in the UK, but we also look at a book really interesting initiatives, for example, in South Africa, where the steel workers, you wouldn't think they would be at the forefront of climate change action, but the steel workers have started to get together in this union called NUMSA to actually put working research groups to look at how they can transition an industry which has been very much fossil fuel dependent into one that supports public and community-owned energy. So the workers there are really at the forefront of saying we want We want to work for something we believe in, not something we don't. And they're putting forward strategies about how to do that. We also saw, and Ben talks about it, that this idea that we have to respond with crises it's often a narrative that, you know, people will get desperate, we'll start fighting each other. And we see films and books that reinforce that. You know, there's this whole idea that as soon as things get scarce, suddenly we become kind of barbarians and start hacking each other to death to get a loaf of bread. But actually what you find in the actual real stories, and there's a really good book by Rebecca Solnit who looks at this, is she looks at five disasters and is the huge inspiring amount of things that go on the ground in Katrina, where communities found out where the elderly person was in their street when they weren't being rescued and then made sure to go and get them, who then would go and get food and make sure that everyone was being looked after. Cuba is an amazing example of where they have some of the worst hurricanes, but they actually have less deaths. When Hurricane Sandy hit New York, they actually got less deaths in Cuba than in Sandy. So there is a very kind of inspiring responses when you see it when it's most needed. I just want to end with a story, and it is about Hurricane Sandy, which actually happened 3 years ago, almost to the date. And at that time, there was a huge storm surge that came in, and it flooded the metro. It knocked out the whole bit of Manhattan. But guess what? There was one building that was still alight. Some of you might know what it was. The one building that was still alight after all the hospitals and metro shut down was Goldman Sachs. And that was because it was surrounded by sandbags, and it had its own in generator. And that was very much, for me, as a symbol of a global economy gone wrong, where you have a private company secure and the public districts dispossessed around it. But the final part of the story is the most interesting part, because what happened at that time is that the Occupy movement that really brought Goldman Sachs to light suddenly got really mobilized. And at one point, they had 60,000 volunteers coming out of 10 hubs distributing food, and they were shaming the national government. There was an incredible community response. They completely eclipsed the soldiers who'd been sent in. Were distributing at one point something like 15,000 meals. So for me, that's where hope lies. I think that we have a capacity to respond to the climate crisis in a very different way, with compassion and creativity rather than with fear and security. And I think it's very exciting that so many different organizations have got involved in tonight's event, because I think that shows that desire to do that. And that's very much what I hope also Joe can talk about, this kind of community responses that we can do to this crisis, which are very different to ones of fear and repression.
Excellent. Thank you very much for that uplifting end and the promise for more uplifting and exciting ideas and examples and maybe some experiences and thoughts about community responses.
Great, thank you. So I haven't contributed to the book, but I started reading it last week and it's great and I really recommend it. I agree with something set out in the introduction and what you also said, Ben, that as a movement we need to engage with this critical this critique that there is a militarized response to climate change. But what I do take heart is that there are alternative framings coming up and we can engage with that and strengthen the movement. So I'm going to specifically talk about energy democracy as one alternative framing for energy security. There's a chapter in this book written by the Platform Collective, which very eloquently paints a picture why energy security is a very, very dangerous framing, and then does touch on alternative framings, and one of them is energy democracy. There isn't a specific definition for energy democracy, but I wanted to read out one that's offered by an organization called Trade Unions for Energy Democracy, which is headquartered in New York, and it's definitely an organization you should look up, because it's a network of over 100 trade unions from around the world who have come together to commit to energy democracy. And this is the labor and the climate movement coming together, and this is really exciting. And they define or suggest energy democracy having three themes. which is to resist the dominant agenda of large energy corporations, to reclaim to public sphere parts of the energy that a system that have been privatized, and to restructure the global energy system to scale up renewable energy and aggressively implement energy conservation measures to ensure job creation and local wealth and assert democratic control. And we're already seeing this in really practical examples. The most sort of established examples are energy cooperatives, and energy cooperatives have spearheaded the wind revolution in Denmark and taken Denmark out of fossil fuel dependency. Energy cooperatives have also spearheaded the solar revolution in Germany. So these are energy democracy is working as an alternative frame. But the examples are far and few between, and it's up to us to start to mobilize. But energy democracy goes beyond energy cooperatives. It also can include local governments working in partnership with community groups and worker cooperatives, and this is really exciting. We're seeing the remunicipalization of local grids in Germany and also local energy, democratically run local energy companies being called for and campaigned again in Germany. They're way ahead of us, but I'm hearing murmurs of seeds being planted in this country for calling for democratically owned local energy supply companies, and I hope that in the months coming up, this movement really takes root, and I urge that you get involved and support that. I'd also like to talk about the divestment movement in this country offers a route to invest in a just and democratic energy transition. And this is because I feel divestment isn't just a commitment about getting funds out of fossil fuels. It's also an opportunity for us to use the capital that will be unlocked by commitments to divestment and reinvest that into a just and a democratic low-carbon transition. They might talk about the politics of austerity, but our wealth is here in pension funds. These are our pension funds in university endowments, and it's our opportunity now. It's here to not just secure those divestment commitments, but take an active part in reshaping what there's reinvested in. I'd like to highlight one particular opportunity, but also a pitfall. This government is very keen on using our pension funds to invest in infrastructure and developing financial mechanisms for that to happen, which is great news when you think about, well, we need a lot of investment in low-carbon infrastructure. It's bad news because the government means fracking infrastructure, airports, and more roads. And this is announcements that are happening now. So we've got to mobilize now. The time is now to take an active part in reshaping or framing what investment into infrastructure means. And in large part, that means we have to raise our financial literacy. And this is not something that's ever really talked about in the climate movement, because it's not seen as, you know, we think of engineering skills or food growing skills as really important skills for the low carbon transition. Of course they are. But financial literacy is really, really important too, because big finance, which is also part of the militarization of climate change, counts on us for being too bamboozled by all these derivatives, etc., to take a part in shaping investment decisions, to have a say in where capital is directed. So we're going to outdo them by raising our financial literacy. And this is very, very much part of energy democracy. There's two other areas of energy democracy which I also like to bring up, which are opportunities in this country. One of them is that we have offshore wind potential. We really need to make sure that we're not fleeced the way we were from North Sea oil revenues were fleeced. It's the oil corporations and arm corporations that, you know, benefited from the revenues of North Sea oil. At the moment, the Green Investment Bank is investing in our offshore wind potential in partnership with fossil fuel companies. This is ridiculous. There are public-private investment partnerships happening. We need to actively call for our civic institutions like local authorities and universities to use their divested money to reinvest in renewable energy, such as offshore wind, and create public-public investment partnerships and public-public governance structures, which not only directs investment into renewable energy, but also earmarked the benefits for reinvestment into economic activities that have clear social and environmental goals through institutions that have clear, transparent and participatory democratic structures. And this is really key. Participatory democracy is what we need to get into the transition to low-carbon futures. And the final area where energy democracy also touches on is the decommissioning of North Sea oil. Platform have done a lot of work, it's referenced in this chapter. This is going to be a much harder area for us to have wins, because we really need the state, the central state, to lead this decommissioning process. But it's possible, and Platform's done brilliant work, that the ones who wrote the chapter on energy security, outlining how this is possible to not just leave at least two-thirds of fossil fuel reserves in the ground, but also to slow extraction rates and oversee the reskilling of those people whose jobs are currently in the oil industry, reskilling into decommissioning industry and then into a retrofitting industry. So all this is possible. And I think what I'd like to end on is that here as individuals, I know I'm already speaking to a converted audience, but I think we, you know, I think like if we went away and chose to either get involved in a local energy cooperative or in a local community group or our local divestment campaign, or to start a a campaign calling for a democratic local energy supply company, that would be great, because that's what we need. Because it's happening, but we need to get stronger, we need to get louder, we need to delegitimize framings, security framings like energy security, and getting behind framings like energy democracy is definitely one way to do that. Thanks.
Thank you very much. That was a great ending, and I'll just abuse my my power as the moderator to add something in that's very related to the topic of the book, that I think one of the ways that we're seeing right now this the conflation of security concerns, or using that murky language to clamp down on people's movements and for corporations especially to stay in the driver's seat, is that the Tory government has recently announced through a press release a clampdown on local authority divestments. So this is an intention that was put out, and we're going to see it slowly implemented in the coming months. So it's a really perfect example. And in the press release, what was specifically named is local authorities that are doing divestment focused on the arms trade, and divestment focused on companies that are complicit in the Israeli occupation. So looking at particular movements that have been using divestment as a tool and clamping down on those movements. The powerful thing is that because there's amazing divestment movement happening around on fossil fuels, we're able to get together all of these different movements that have overlapping membership and very aligned goals in terms of people's movements and democracy, and we're kind of putting up a united front to some of this this repression. So I think it's a really perfect example both of the securitization and also of the kind of united front that we can put up in fighting for our ability to use divestment, for example, as one of the many tools that we have in our toolbox. So hopefully also everybody in this room will be excited to participate in that as our resistance sort of unfolds. With that, I think it's time to open it up to the floor for questions, and maybe I'll take three questions at a time, and then we'll hear again from the panel. And of course, as the moderator will always say, please focus on questions rather than lengthy comments. And now is the time to get all of those amazing stories from the book out into this room. So anybody want to start us off? I see one over there.
Hello. Is it working? So quite a broad question, but relevant, I think. What are your views on corporate social responsibility?
I think it's a red herring.
Are there other questions that we can take? But that was a good start. Yes.
Hi. Thank you very much. Really, really interesting speeches. I have a question about divestment. I'm part of a local divestment initiative, and next week we are going to have a meeting with the pension fund, and they've already sort of given us an oral answer as to why they shouldn't divest, and they say that there is a very strong argument for engagement. And I've read the local authorities' pension fund sort of document that's just come out this year, and they kind of, I anticipate they're going to give us some arguments for engagement rather than divestment. I'm just wondering if you could give me some ideas about counter-arguments for the engagement angle.
Is there one more before we respond to this?
Recently I saw the proposed changes to government's foreign aid budget, and it looks like what they're trying to do is link the provision of foreign aid to security and militarism by basically aligning investment in infrastructure in developing countries with military priorities, so around Syria, I guess linked to kind of oil pipelines, other kind of types of infrastructure governments involved in. At the same time, we've got government defunding things like renewables in the UK and opening us up to foreign investment from China. So it looks like we've got this kind of weird trend going on where we're sort of increasing national spending and decreasing local spending on things like energy. How can we sort of counter these trends? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Okay, we'll take... should we start with the red herring? And then we can just go this way, yeah.
Well, I haven't kept up with corporate social responsibility debates, but whenever I come across them, it sounds like greenwash. It sounds to me that corporations I think the people within CSR teams probably are well-intentioned, but I think where CSR fits in a wider corporate directional strategy is about putting up a certain public image that the corporations are doing something good, but I essentially see it as greenwash or redwash. Yeah, that's my view. We should definitely talk more after this because we can go into quite a lot of technical details. And unfortunately, the Local Authority Pension Fund Forum came out, I don't know, a couple of months ago, right after the big data disclosure happened on local authorities saying that they're just against divestment. So that's already a block up. Engagement. There are documents that we can refer to. Conservative organisations, advisors like Mercer are saying that we at least need partial divestment. So that's one way in, even if they're not willing to commit to full divestment. The second thing is that I think people forget that divestment doesn't mean pulling money out immediately. It's a phased process. And divestment doesn't necessarily... And because it's a phased process, engagement to a certain extent can still happen side by side. But... as Ben pointed out, or maybe it was Nick, what is the point of engaging with organisations, so companies like Shell and BP, when you're really asking them to not exist in the future? Like, that doesn't make sense. And so far, engagement is only engaging on issues like exploration and tar sands in the Arctic, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. That's not ambitious enough to limit... global temperature rise. So we can go into quite a lot of technical detail and we can provide some information after this that you can take with you.
Yeah, I maybe just also adding into, I think, on the divestment issue. Of course, look, the climate scientists tell us if you want to keep temperatures below 1.5, you've got about 7 years of the existing carbon budget left. If you want to keep for 2 degrees, it's probably... maximum 15 to 20 years. So the model as we know it is just not compatible. And of course, climate scientists say you've got to keep 80% of non-fossil fuels in the ground to be able to do that. And of course, we in the north have overconsumed our share of the carbon budget and of course are responsible for the majority of the pollution out there. Now, it's not possible, I think, in terms of the question about whether we should be transforming corporations. Because, look, the dirty energy corporations knew the climate science well before anybody else did. I mean, if you look at their revelations about Exxon and Chevron, etc., they knew full well. And then they engaged in decades and decades of taking out the rule book of what they did with big tobacco did in terms of confusion. Now, where we are, it's not about transition. I mean, a lot of the fossil fuel companies talk about that they need to be part of the transition, as if we're going to move from coal to oil to something else, to gas, etc. Where actually we need to leapfrog all of those. And the reality is that it's impossible. The model of the multinational can't deliver the kind of energy access and the off-grid that you require. So the model that you need for energy in the UK and globally is not suited for the actual kind of, you know, big multinational corporation anymore. Actually, what you need is much more decentralised, community-owned, municipality-owned energy systems. And of course, the dirty energy corporations are continuing. I mean, the IMF earlier this year put out a figure saying that we hand over in direct and indirect subsidies to dirty energy corporations $5.4 trillion. You know, that's $10 million per minute. And that's an incredible amount when you talk about, you know, that we can't even find less than $30 billion for the poorest countries dealing with climate impacts. And they say, well, austerity, and we haven't got that money. So I think there is a fight, and it's an existential fight, and they realise that. Our job is we're trying to toxify a whole industry, take it down one by one and create something different. And what they're saying is, actually, you don't need to change anything. The model doesn't need to change. We can just tinker with the edges. And I think that brings us in terms of CSR. Look, the reality is many people have engaged, and we all know that we have to have many tools in our campaign box when we're fighting against corporate power. And maybe there was a role for CSR at one point, and I do think there probably was, at least in terms of some engagement. But the reality of whether we're talking about the industrial agricultural system or, you know, dirty energy corporations or logging companies, because if you want to tackle the climate crisis, you know, you have to change the way we consume, produce energy and food, and stop cutting down trees. If you want to do all of those three things, you actually can't do CSR. If you look at, for example, the Indonesia and the fires in the Indonesia in terms of the forests, you know, there are those companies that have got the concessions, most of them have got CSRs. Most of them have got actual plans where they say we are going to be sustainable palm oil producers. But the reality is that their model of whether the pulp or oil, palm oil is also about, you know, forest burning down the forest fires. And I think they're trying to hoodwink us, you know, because they know that what we're actually trying to fight for, and so there's a huge coalition of groups, including Transnational Institute, trying to fight for about how do you regulate corporations? How do you stop corporations from having the kind of power that they're having, about influencing our decision makers in the way that they do, about having legal entities as an individual, how in the trade agreements they've got these secret trade courts. How do we limit all of those? How do we put more responsibility on them via, like, for example, you know, new human rights legislation to govern transnational corporations, which they're not governed at all by. So I would say very much in terms of that. I forgot what the conference, the question, the third one. Sorry, my pen. What your question you were asking about?
It was about basically DFID and the international aid being now linked to military. So the tactical military.
Absolutely. So in terms of climate finance, you look at the climate finance, and this is, of course, you know, a legal obligation because it's under the polluter pay, historical responsibility, it's all there. What's happened in the last 10 years is that, of course, the majority of the climate finance that has been provided has been existing overseas development aid. It's just been relabeled. Of the $30 billion that was in short, fast start finance that was meant to give them between 2010 and 2012, only one-tenth of that was new money. Of the money between that, the governments have decided they're going to give $100 billion, which of course was a figure plucked out of the air by Hillary Clinton in Copenhagen. It has no bearing on what the needs were. Of that, the majority is private finances, multinational banks, etc. But recently, just what, 2 weeks ago, the European Union was meeting with the African Union, you know, and in the midst of the crisis of bodies being washed up in the Mediterranean, it was talking about how do you use overseas development aid to build fences, you know, how do you use it to provide military apparatus for the Egyptian regime to prevent people from even getting to the coastline. Line. So when we look at how the government talks about ODA money, so it says, of course, we look how great we are. We've got 0.7% of our GDP. Isn't that brilliant? We're like way ahead of everybody else. But when you actually look at what they're doing with their money, well, what are they doing? They're giving money to KPMG to privatise the Nigerian electricity sector. The very moment when you need the actual state to own energy to be able to provide energy access, they're saying, bring the market approach to it. And that ultimately is the big thing. I mean, you know, in the climate negotiations, it's not that these countries don't want to take action on climate. They just don't want to take responsibility for it. And they want to make sure that the action is done, it benefits them. And that, I think, once we look at that perspective, all of the, you know, what we was last week, the CAFOD did a study which said 5.7 billion of taxpayer money goes to dirty energy corporations around the world. From there, we have got 1.7 billion we give to fracking and oil companies in tax breaks in this UK. We've just put a legal obligation into the infrastructure bill to maximise our hydrocarbon resources. See, these are all things at the same time as we're saying we're tackling climate change, we're actually saying we're empowering our dirty energy corporations, which brings me back to why there's no absolute CSR for me as a red herring as well.
Thank you.
I agree with much of what I agree with what Asad said, and the only thing I'd add was I think what we're seeing at international level, TNI works with, has been working very much on a campaign to look at binding regulation for corporations. And what we, this is actually something that was very close to being approved back in the 1970s. And it was very much undermined as soon as Reagan came to power. This whole idea of regulation of corporations was, of course, shoved right off the agenda. And CSR emerged as the corporate response to that. And what we're seeing is this kind of voluntary, we can govern ourselves approach is suddenly affecting everything. You see it again in the climate negotiations. There were binding agreements around how much you could cut your emissions by. Now it's all, we will make voluntary pledges. Mm-hmm. And it's very much part now of international governance, which does not require accountability. It's all very much on voluntary, self-serving initiatives. And what that's done is it's really reduced the accountability. So many of the communities that TNI works with are saying, you know, this company has a wonderful CSR report, but we've had paramilitaries kill our trade union leaders, and we've had our river completely devastated, and we have no system of justice. And so that's why Tina is very much involved in this international campaign to say that there must be binding regulations. And really, I'd say that needs to be kind of brought in right across the board, because it cannot be for US to say, it's not a matter of justice for US to say we will reduce by, in the end, you know, a few percent when actually justice and science requires a very different response. We need to return to these ideas of international accountability.
Thank you.
I'll just maybe add something really short on your question. You know, you're absolutely right, and it actually dates back, I think, to about 2011 when the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats established the National Security Council, and they said basically now all, you know, I mean, development's always been the handmaiden of security, but this, you know, made it explicit that we are only going to do humanitarian work and development work where we have a national security or national economic interest, right? You know, what do we do about it? The first thing we can do is start to subject the aid budget and the development budget to the kind of scrutiny it needs. You know, Asad mentioned how it's being used, you know, primarily to try and keep refugees in the place they are, you know, preventing them from coming to Europe. If you look at, you know, our partners in this new global partnership for countering violent extremism, you know, we chair a working group with the United Arab Emirates at the Global Counterterrorism Forum, whose idea of countering violent extremism is, you know, locking up and deporting Shia Muslims. And I think that really, one of the positive things I think that's coming out from the sort of discussions about where we are now in Paris is really, you know, the focus on Saudi Arabia. I mentioned it before, but I think, you know, just, I think people in Britain really get this, you know, that you know, our biggest ally in the Middle East is also, you know, the hypocrisy of this. It is also the source of so much of the problems that we're supposed to be countering. And I think, you know, as I say, trying to call out the hypocrisy of what we're doing and trying to get, you know, not just Britain but other countries to absolutely, you know, rethink our entire relationship with,
you know, tyrannical and despotic regimes in the Middle East. I think that is something that is, you know, we're at the beginning of a process where I'm confident that that is going to start to happen because, you know, it is just so ridiculous that 2015, that's where we are.
Thank you. There were some, I think there was another hand over there. Can you raise your hands very high? Yes, back there, and then you, and then we'll come back to you.
You've already touched on it, but it's just this notion that, you know, organisations, companies like Shell, they know the game is up, actually. They know that they cannot continue to bring fossil fuel out of the ground, and they're talking in their scenario planning about this. Okay, how long will it take them to change? But is there a fear that they may even, that they're trying to hold on to power and will colonise renewables? I mean, it could be as extreme as let's privatise the sun. We know people have already privatised water. I mean, that's maybe a bit far-fetched, but how do we actually prevent that so that they take the initiative because they have the power now and will hold on to it and continue?
Hi. My question is, how do you enforce a transnational capping system without the military? What would a transnational, how would the transnational enforcement work if you were to enforce something that was effective as opposed to cap and trade or whatever else COP is, they're debating at the COP next week.
Sorry, what, transnational enforcement of what?
Of capping emissions, capping, or any reform of energy systems anywhere.
Hi. So I was just, in terms of trying to link up the climate justice movement with all the social issues, which is what has to happen and should happen, etc., just thinking about that and the response in Europe to, the right word isn't refugee crisis because there's a permanent refugee crisis, but hundreds of thousands of people are trying to get into Europe just recently, and the fact that a lot of people in Europe, as in people on the ground and at football matches or whatever, were very welcoming to those people. Is it useful for the climate justice movement in different countries in Europe especially to talk about climate refugees and to say that the people from Syria are climate refugees, but on the other hand, taking into account to say that this isn't some apocalyptic kind of situation that's happening where if there are lots of refugees coming from Syria because of climate issues that suddenly we need to put up massive fences to stop them coming in. So is it useful and how should that be done?
I'll start this way this time.
I'll start with that question. I mean, I think we should talk about climate refugees in the sense that, you know, people are going to move as a result of climate change. But I think we've got to be, you know, I mean, we've got to be very careful about where this leads. You know, when you read all of these state national security and climate change strategies, you know, they don't really say what they're going to do, but it's always the elephant in the room, you know, the specter of, you know, millions. I think Christian Aid put out a report about 5 years ago that said 1 billion people are going to be forced to leave their homes as a result of climate change in the next 50 years, you know, and it's, when you put that into the, you know, the pockets of the people responsible for devising appropriate security responses, it's a very, you know, it's a very dangerous narrative. I think if you sort of switch to the current crisis, you know, you've really got to ask yourself, well, who created this crisis? You've got to ask yourself that at two points. You know, one, obviously, firstly, you know, why are these people coming here, and you know, what role does, what responsibility does Europe bear towards that, not just in terms of living up to the Geneva Conventions, but also acknowledging the fact that, you know, countries within the European Union, you know, bear fundamental responsibility for the mess that Iraq and Syria are in. But I think, you know, you've also got to say that one of the reasons we're in such a mess is because of the security policies that we've adopted over the last 25 years. And, you know, everyone's sort of saying now, oh, well, you know, how can we be sure that all these refugees, they're not terrorists and they're involved in the Paris attacks and all of that? Well, you know, one of the ways you could do that would be to give them a safe legal route of passage into the European Union to make an asylum claim in the first place, you know. And really, if you want to understand where we are in terms of immigration and asylum policy, you know, you've got to go back really to the sort of mid to late 90s when, you know, we actually had a refugee crisis with similar kinds of numbers. You know, you had Kurds fleeing, you know, Iraq, coming from Greece and Turkey. You had the collapse of the Balkans, you know, lots of people fleeing those conflicts. And, you know, a lot of these people came to Europe, they got asylum status, some stayed, some went home, we dealt with it. But the policy response to that was saying, right, we've got to make sure that these kind of mass influxes, to use the policy-making words, never happen again. And European states have basically spent the last, you know, 20 to 25 years, you know, outsourcing responsibility for refugees, using aid and trade to persuade countries of origin and transit of migrants to adopt all of these measures, you know, criminalising illegal exit, you know, going after the smugglers. And, you know, at the end of the day, you've ended up with a European Union that has basically abdicated its responsibilities under the Geneva Conventions by just saying, we're not going to give people a safe route in. And I think if we're going to be asking for anything, you know, it's one, it's, you know, right, cool heads. Yes, the numbers are big and they seem alarming, but this is something that Europe could deal with quite easily, given the political will. You know, the second thing we've got to be asking for is just, you know, give these people a safe and legal route in to make a claim in the first instance, and then start to think pragmatically about what to do with them, you know.
And just briefly to add to that, on climate refugees, I think one of the things I think the international community as a whole and it will need to recognise is that migration is going to become an adaptation strategy. It's already happening in small ways, you know Bolivia, but people are moving up the mountain in small ways because they could no longer grow crops at the level that they were at. So this migration is going to be a reality that we can't just respond to it by just using mass drownings in the Mediterranean Sea as a way. That's no humane response, and that is the response we're following. So we're going to have to recognise and facilitate safe passage and enable people to migrate who need to migrate, and support those to stay who can. In terms of kind of corporations and the Exxon, the thing that came to mind was that I think some investment funds looked at, I think it was Exxon, and said, is there a danger of these stranded assets? If we have this international agreement where we have to reduce by to keep it under 2 degrees, and that means you can't take out 80%, does that mean all these investments that you're selling as assets are stranded in some way? And so Exxon did this study and said, well, basically, because their answer effectively was, because we control the political process, we don't think that the 2 degree thing will happen, so we're safe. And so that's how much confidence they have that they do control the current political process, and why they've actually had so little even investment into renewables. It's been largely a green show. And finally, around the kind of enforcement around cap and carbon emissions, I think one thing that's important to recognise, again, comes back to international governance, but we do have international enforcement mechanisms for trade. They're very clear ones. If you break a free trade rule, you will get trade penalties enforced, and enforced by the World Trade Organization or enforced by bilateral investment treaty courts, arbitration courts. So for a trade infrastructure, so things that is the spread of capital, there are enforcement mechanisms. But for human rights and environment, strangely, there isn't any kind of enforcement mechanism. So there are possibilities of getting enforcement mechanisms. There just hasn't been the will to put them in place.
Thanks for that.
So just to maybe start with that multilateral. So, of course, we've got a problem with the global commons. So when you have a problem with the global commons and you know it's, no matter what you're doing within your national boundaries, it requires a multilateral agreement to be able to deal with this. There are two component elements to that. One, is what I'm doing fair? And two, am I doing it? And so, first of all, the problem is that, of course, there's no fairness in terms of what people are doing. You've heard we've deregulated the climate regime. Now it's do what you want when you can. You put an INDC. You would think that this, when we're a global crisis, what you would say is there's this much carbon left in the atmosphere, this is what we need to share fairly, and this is what everybody has to do, and then legally bind that and make sure we've got enforcement mechanisms. And there are plenty of enforcement mechanisms. You don't need an army to enforce the mechanisms. It's the fact that actually there's no political will. So when Canada walked out of the Kyoto Protocol, that was it. People just shrugged. When Japan, Australia, New Zealand said, we're not even going to bother putting any targets into the second commitment period of Kyoto, nobody said anything. I mean, that I think it's a question, again, about power, and it's also about what are we doing? How are we shining the spotlight? And I think we've not, as a movement, have generally been weak in terms of on climate issues. On climate refugees, I would think, you know, the two hardest things probably in this country to work on is, the hardest thing ever to work on is refugee issues, I think, in the West, definitely. It's the most godforsaken issue with the least political support from anybody in the political establishment. And then you've got this climate refugee issue. And first of all, nobody ever comes anywhere and says, I'm a climate refugee. Because if you ever say you're a climate refugee, you're not going to be accepted as a refugee because there's no such thing. And of course, the big fear of anybody is, do you open up the refugee convention to create environmental refugee or climate refugee? And everybody knows if you do that, all the same, what little is remaining of the refugee convention will go down the pan, so nobody wants to do it. But there has been mass migration of people and internally displaced people. So the way I think what we've got to deal with is climate around the climate refugees, there's two things. There's one which is, I think, about how do we campaign on it. And I think that is about people-to-people solidarity. I think the fact there are now thousands of people going to Jarlswood and saying, shut it down, these moments give us a way of saying, look, we can put human beings to climate change and what the impacts of climate change. And that's always been a really effective tool for us, I think, as a movement. And I think, secondly, there has got to be in the international mechanism, international negotiations, there's a whole thing about what we're doing about loss and damage, which sounds like what is, but really is about justice for people. What do you do by the fact that you're not going to cut emission reduction, you can't adapt to climate change, and then you're going to have these huge losses? Some people are going to lose literally their nation state. Already Tuvalu, Kiribati have made agreements with New Zealand to move all of their people. Maldives is in discussion with India. You talk to most of the poorest countries and they all say, we know the rich countries aren't going to do anything. We have to now think about how are we going to move our populations? Where are they going to go? So I think there's a thing in terms around the climate refugee stuff. I think just generally in terms about the multinationals and fossil fuels, you know, for too long, the climate crisis has been framed by organisations that have said it doesn't really matter how you get from A to B, as long as you get from A to B. So if the issue is we've got dirty energy, we're polluting the atmosphere, the answer is going for 100% renewable. It doesn't matter if it's owned by the same companies, none of it matters. But actually it does, because that model is not bringing energy to billions of people around the world. And it's not profitable for them to bring energy to the billions of people. So the question is going to be, is what role are these multinationals going to play in terms of it? And we've seen already, we saw, for example, in Mexico, where Walmart is land-grabbing land to build wind turbines to power its factories and displacing people. You see already in many countries resistance happening to clean energy projects because they're actually not for communities. They're about taking energy to other places. So I think if we really want to see this kind of transformation, it's not possible with the same model. So will Shell have a role? Will BP have a role? Personally, I hope not. But our job is to make sure that whatever role they've got is as minimal as possible, and that the other alternative forms of ownership are there, because the fight for those ownership models are part of transforming the economy to deliver the action we need on climate change. You just can't keep this same system and deal with the climate crisis. It's just not possible. So how we do it and how we negotiate it, and do you say BP should shut down automatically overnight? Well, of course, look, for many of us, we don't say that, because we know there are people whose jobs are at risk in terms that we want just transition. But we've seen that. There's been that brilliant example of you talk about in the book about South African metal workers, steel workers, but there's also been in the UK when aerospace in Lancashire, I forgot about Lucas Aerospace from my hometown. You know, was shutting down, and people looked about how to transfer skills. And all of these skills we need them for the new industry and the new... But I'm not interested in the UK dominating the renewable energy system and then selling renewable energy to the rest of the world in terms of... What I'm interested in is, can we create regional hubs? Can we create alternative trade route patterns? Can we create alternative economies? Because you need all of that, because it's not possible for us to have a food system that, you know, take some food from here to South America, back to Europe. It's just not possible to keep business as usual. So,
thank you. Sorry. Yeah, I don't have very much to add, because basically I agree with everything that's said, and I'll just say 2 points. One on framing as refugees, as climate refugees. We have to obviously be careful because every framing is co-opted, but I do think there's a value in recognising the role climate change is playing. And I feel actually, as someone who like teaches urban planners and like built environment professionals who see climate change or green futures as a technical issue, using framings like climate change can bring political economy critiques into their thinking. So I personally think that would be really useful, but it shouldn't be co-opted. You have to be aware of that. And whether Shell would privatise the sun, yep, well, if they could get away with it, they definitely would. And that's what we really have to be vigilant about. And yesterday, in my lecture to the undergraduates on a module called Green Futures, I was talking about climate change and a systemic how it's a systemic issue, and my takeaway message was that it's not just about decarbonising, it's about democratising our economy and our energy system, and that is really, really crucial. And I am so pissed off with all these NGOs who've said it doesn't matter how you get to 100% renewable energy as long as you get there, because they've bloody hijacked it all. Democracy is really, really the crucial thing. It's almost, I'm beginning to think, it's almost even more important than decarbonising. And the reason I mentioned the offshore wind situation, because that's what's happening. It's, you know, we might get our offshore wind potential developed, but if it happens with fossil fuel industry playing a role in that, then we really missed an opportunity here.
So not all NGOs.
Sorry. Some.
Not these ones.
Obviously.
Well, I think this is probably a good time to close up. First, to thank the panel for this really amazing discussion and conversation.
Can I do a quick plug?
In 1 minute, because I'm going to say something important first, which is that after we leave this room, there's wine and snacks somewhere over there. I think a door will open. Yeah. And also, that's the chance for you to buy this incredible book. And it's your lucky day because it's going to be sold at a very discounted price. And also, you can get the editors to sign it and tell you more about it. So please do pick up a copy of the book while you're having wine and snacks, and
so,
you're on.
Thank you. I'm sure you've all seen this flyer and you've probably all been emailed it, but there is a demonstration taking place this Sunday here in London. It's one on Saturday in Edinburgh, but it's taking place all around the world. It's, of course, before the climate negotiations, and many of the themes that we talked about have been fought over very, very hard as to why this march is called, for example, the People's March for Climate, for Justice and for Jobs. And you won't believe how many organisations didn't want any of those things and just wanted the March for Climate. But it is really important, because it's really important not about just about what's going on in Paris, but it's about how are we building the movement here in this country that says no to extractives, that says yes to community power, and a powerful expression of that on Sunday, I think, would really, really be useful. We've got trade unions coming. I think it's a beginning of a vision of a new climate justice movement. So, friends, please do come down if you are around in London.
Thank you. And thanks to everyone for coming.
Thank you.